left off in Genesis 35, and I think we skipped 36 because that's dealing with Esau and his descendants, and we won't go into that again because we've done that before. Actually, we know who Esau is. Esau's Edom, and we've gone back when we were in the Ezekiel study to show who the Edomites are. And the Edomites are one of the peoples that are part of really what we call the Arab or Islamic world. Not all of your Arabs are Ishmael. Some of them are Edomites. A significant number of them are Edomites, and some of them are Arabic or Ishmaelites. So we won't go into that. If you want to go over Genesis 36 on your own study, you can. Or you can get the tape that we did in Ezekiel where we went through the nations. In fact, we did one some time ago where I went through Genesis 10 and all of the different nations and who they are today. I can't remember the name of the tape. Carly would possibly know. You can talk with her. But there was one that I did where I covered each one of the various nations in general that are given in Genesis 10. You can maybe get that and go through it. But we won't go through Ezekiel 36 today. We'll just go straight to Ezekiel 37. Yes? Where some of the nations are now? Okay, because I don't know the title, but I just take your word for it because I don't know the title. But you can talk with Carly, and she has a list of all the tapes, and she can get the one that deals with that subject. And so we won't go over it again today. I wanted to apologize, too. I gave you the wrong web address last week for those who might have been looking for that article from Christian Biblical Church of God. It's, I said CBCG, but there's no O there. So forget the O. It's just CBCG.org. CBCG.org for that article. And the article is by Carl Franklin, and it deals with the history of the calendar to the time of Christ and so forth, even going back to 5 BC when he was born. Yes? That's correct. Thanks. Next week, we will meet an hour later because they're having some memorial service here, I guess, for one of their members. And they won't be out of the building until 1 o'clock, I think. Now, they said we can come at 1, but I figure we'd go ahead and give them an extra half an hour. And we won't come into the building until 1:30, next week. Well, yeah, we'll have everything set up by 1:30, but they're supposed to be out of the hall by 1. But I figured we wouldn't start until 1:30 because we might have a little bit of mobility between them and us for that half-hour period. So we'll start at 1:30 next week. And it is a potluck next week. That's right. I forgot that, too. It's a potluck next week, so please bring your best dishes, and let's make it a really good one, especially since we're meeting a little later in that afternoon too as well. Okay, so again, that's cbcg.org, www.cbcg.org. So I messed up last time. Want to make sure you get the article. Also want to let you know that the article, not everyone might not benefit from it because it is somewhat scholarly written. It is complex. There is mathematics in it that is somewhat complex. It's basic mathematics, but the methodology of the mathematics is somewhat complex. And if you're not so inclined to wade through that kind of stuff, then you might become sort of exhausted early on. So I thought I'd forewarn you. Which to me, though, is a good example when you get into the article, a good example why God kept the calendar within a certain, province of certain people, certain individuals. And it is just even a greater proof that God intended for the Jews to preserve the calendar and did not intend for it to be something everyone was supposed to be doing. He didn't intend that. God intended, in fact, for there to be a continual connection between us and the Jewish people down to the time of Christ's return. You realize that? He never intended for there to be a disconnection. You know, if you read in Romans, it shows quite plainly, even in respect to the Gentile, that the Gentile is grafted into the tree, grafted into Israel. And Paul even refers to the church as the Israel of God, but we're grafted in. Certain things God intended to always be that connection where we always kind of look toward, you know, the Jew as where all of the things that God has done has originated from or through. And God has always intended that to be the case and never wants us to have that separation from that. And yet, there's another element God wants, and that's for us to have faith and confidence in what He is able to do in spite of the frailty of human beings. And one of the things we should notice as we go through this Genesis series, it's very clear, is it not? As we look at Genesis, and as we've gone through from Adam all the way down now, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now down to Joseph, getting ready to deal with Joseph now alongside of Jacob. And as we watch, as we've sort of, you know, parade through all these events, what have we seen? We've seen the frailty of men and of women, and we've seen God's faithfulness to His promises and His covenant. He hasn't failed, not one time, in spite of the frailty of the people He was dealing with. When God said, there's some prophecies, by the way, we'll get to Genesis 49, where when we get to Genesis 49, we're going to go a little more extensively in some of the fulfillments in history relating to Israel. You know, who they are now, today, which we all know, but just giving a few more facts of that information. And we're going to deal also with, in 49, about Judah, the scepter, and the birthright promise, the promise of a lawgiver, and all these things. And showing from that very prophecy in Genesis 49, God, in effect, made a covenant in which He would still use the Jews to maintain His law. It's a prophecy. Right there. Little, simple, worded prophecy. Right there. And then there's some other places in Scripture that I've gone through this past week. I've read those Scriptures many times. You know how you read stuff and you never put it together, you never relate it in the right way. It's there, you see it. It's a good Scripture. But a couple of Scriptures that I able to go through this past week just blew my mind, in which God has shown clearly that He would place certain responsibilities with the Jews and He would not take it back and make sure they would do it. And there's some Scriptures there in the Psalms, I believe in Jeremiah, Acts, and then, of course, Romans. And when you put them all together, it is clear that God has made this commitment to do this in spite of themselves. And do we think God can't do it? Do we think He's weak? One other thing that should be very clear as we go through Genesis is the sovereignty of God, that He's in control of moving nations, geographical boundary lines, the weather, the environment, you name it. All of these things God is using for the carrying out of His plan. I even believe, you know, after I've studied into it somewhat, I truly believe that even the ice ages were caused by God in order to shift boundaries around the world because of what God was doing at that time. Boundaries shifted. Human beings had to move. They couldn't stay in a particular place because of the ice. They had to leave. And some of this stuff happened rather suddenly, not over some long period of time like they try to make you believe in geology or geography, I should say. No, geology. Geologic time and all that kind of good stuff. They're trying to make you believe it took place over long periods of time, but it did not. It happened suddenly. The indications are that it happened suddenly, and we got evidence of it today with your woolly mammoths up there in Siberia and Alaska, frozen with tropical vegetation in their mouths. That wasn't over a long period of time. And then, you know, they don't even put that in the books. They won't even deal with that. They don't even want to deal with that. And they're still digging them up right now, up in Siberia and Alaska, up in the frozen tundra. They have ice fields filled with these woolly mammoths. They're still digging them up. They were frozen suddenly. Why did that happen? I have no doubt God was changing. You know, it is God who changes the times. God who says in Acts, the 17th chapter, who has set the boundaries, and also in Deuteronomy 32, who has set the boundaries of the nations. That's what it says. And like we went into the sermon on the sovereignty of God several months back, God is sovereign. And as we read through Genesis, we see it. He is sovereign, and he is also sovereign in each one of your lives. He was sovereign in Otha's life this week. You see? He's sovereign in each of our lives. We don't know, brother. We don't know in how many different ways in our individual lives God is involved invisibly behind the scene. And maybe we go years and look back and we start to see it. When we get into this story now, Joseph, you'll see that, because there are things that are happening. Joseph didn't even understand what some of these things meant until they were fulfilled later. And he was put through hell, to put it in modern lingo. Put through hell. And didn't understand what was going on. And yet, he didn't lose faith, though. Trusted God through it all. So let's take a look now, back at Genesis, starting with Genesis 37. To me, Genesis, I tell you, this is a... I hope everyone has gotten a lot out of this so far. I know I have. And I hope that you've gone back over it or done some of your own study and reading of it and meditating on these things, because there's such a powerful lessons that are in the book of Genesis as God lays the foundation for the fulfillment of his plan through the ages. Do you realize what was laid here? We are in the midst of the reverberation from what happened 4,000 years ago. Realize that? We're in the midst of it right now. Laid out by God in advance. God, who is able to foretell the things that are yet to come and the things that are not as if they were. God, who is able to do things like that. And when we look in the scripture, we see it. So Genesis 37, story of Joseph begins here, and to me it is one of the most fascinating stories in all of the Bible, and heartwarming stories. And if you don't get a tear in your eye at the end of that story, something's got to be wrong with you. Because I know every time I read it, you know, it's a funny thing. Every time I read it, I always tell myself, I'm not going to cry this time. Every time I read it, and I get to the end of that story, you know, when Joseph and his brothers are finally revealed to each other, you cannot help but get tears. You cannot help it. It's really, you know, if they were to make movies from the Bible, the way the Bible is, they would be the most exciting and interesting and inspiring movies you ever saw in your life. But every time they get a hold of something in the Bible, though, they create these sentimental rubbish. You know, they can go out and make a movie on some fantasy movie, but all the special effects and everything else and just a hit. If they were to take that same talent and applied it to the Bible and did it exactly the way the Bible is, they'd have the best movies they ever created. Intrigue, murder, war, romance, adventure, bravery, courage, you name it, all the issues that affect human life, they would be able to put it in a movie from the Bible. They could do it. And I look at the story of Joseph. It is one of the most fascinating and heartwarming, adventurous stories. But underneath that adventure is so many lessons of faith and of God's sovereignty and what he's working out. Chapter 37, and Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lads were with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now, right off the bat, Joseph starts out with a little problem here. First of all, it appears that he was closer to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah than he was with the sons of Leah. Wasn't as close to them. He seemed to have favored the illegitimate children more than his other brothers. So there was some division among them. We've already seen that Jacob has had a lot of problems in his family. Now Bilhah and, the children of Bilhah and Zilpah give Jacob an evil report. It was a true report, by the way. Actually, I believe that it deals with Reuben. I really believe that's what it dealt with. I think it even says so somewhere down the line. But I believe it dealt with that. And as we know, Reuben went into his father's concubine. Well, Joseph was a very righteous guy. And he was rather self-righteous. And as you see through here, Joseph was rather self-righteous. He was a young 17-year-old, kind of an arrogant, like most teenagers tend to be. Teenagers, you know, that age, 16, 17, they know it all. They have this sense of righteousness, boy. They can tell their parents, you know, I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Teenagers are like that. But Joseph was no different at age 17. But God also had chosen him. God also had chosen him. Going on. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. Uh-oh, another problem. Another problem. Because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And that happens a lot of times. You know, you get older, you learn from a lot of your mistakes that you made with your other children, and now the youngest one gets the benefit of all the mistakes that have been made to all the other ones. So you're better. That's why a lot of parents are better at grandparenting, because they've learned. And in their old age now, they apply these things to this younger child that they didn't do with the other children. And that younger child is favored. And in this case, Joseph was favored, and that created problems. Because there was always, you can see there was already a problem. He was spending hanging out most of his time with the other children of Bilhah and Zilpah. And there's no doubt there must have been a little bit of something between him and the other brothers already. And now, the father shows this special favor toward Joseph. He saw something special about him. And the father was drawn to what he saw in Joseph. And the other sons, well, let's read on. So the father made Joseph a coat of many colors. Now, I don't know exactly what colors it was, but I get the impression, and I think I've heard in the past, I seem to vaguely recall in the past a minister saying that this coat may have been a coat of royalty, or had colors of royalty in it, or may have even related to someone who would be the firstborn or the birthright, and Joseph was not the firstborn in the house. So this coat of many colors was given to him that sort of, in a way, sort of elevated him above the other brethren. So he gave him this coat, and when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him, meaning they were arguing with him about something all the time because of jealousy. They argued with him. And Joseph did not make it any better. Let's go on. Verse 5, and Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brother, and they hated him yet the more. Now that was not a wise thing. But see, he was a teenager. And he had this dream that came from God. You know, if you have dreams like the dreams God gives you, they're like real. It's not like our dreams that, you know, sort of in this here shadow dimension we go into when we sleep. But it's like being right here, walking around like here. It's a profound, powerful experience. This is why when I hear someone say, I dreamed a dream, you know, I'm very suspect. The Bible gives us examples and principles to go by as to how God deals, and that's what we should use. Scripture says, try the spirits, whether it be of God. So if someone comes to you with a dream, you try the spirit, whether it be of God or not. And how do you do that? Well, God has given us the example of how he does it. When God gives a dream, it's not selfishly oriented, for one thing. And it's because he has a mission for you. He has a mission. And all the dreams that you read about in the Bible, every one of those dreams related to something that was the will of God being revealed in some profound and powerful way and to be carried forth. So when someone comes to me and say they had a dream, I've heard people tell me all kinds of dreams I've heard. Someone recently came to me and mentioned to me about a dream that somebody had about them. And they told me about this dream. They knew I was religious and all that, so I guess they thought I could interpret dreams, but I don't have that gift. But they came to me and told me about this dream. So I told them flat out, I said, well, you know, it sounds like to me, you know, maybe they ate too much, or, you know, or maybe they were under pressure or some experience they went through during the day. And then I was honest with them. I said, you know, when the Bible gives dreams, it's something profoundly different from that kind of thing. And, you know, it's not what that person told you. Nothing like that at all. So be careful of that. You know, there are other miraculous gifts that God gives in the Bible, and Satan the devil attempts to duplicate or counterfeit those things. But use the Bible to test it, because there's coming a time shortly in which there's going to be a great counterfeiting of gifts. And so we have to be on our toes and very sharp to analyze these things. In fact, the Bible said things are going to be so bad that even the very elect potentially could be deceived by it. So you have to be sharp. So he had this dream, and it was very real to him, and he was also exalted in it. You know what I'm trying to say? He was exalted in it, Joseph was. See, his father had already made him feel like he was number one. His father had given him the coat and was treating him as extra special. Then he has this dream, and he knew what this dream meant. He knew what it meant. Now, why would you go to your brothers and tell them something like this unless there's got to be a little bit of arrogance on your part? Maybe his father, but to his brothers? Anyway, he went to them and he said this. And he said, and here I pray you this dream which I dream. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. Now, why would you tell your brother something like that? You know, it was his way of saying, I am righteous and God has chosen me, but you guys are not righteous, and he's going to make you bow before. I know you talk about me like a dog when I'm not around, but guess what?
Question about the where it says coat of many colors.
Right.
And I was reading in my Bible where it says a long robe. It doesn't say coat of many colors. And that's out of the interlinear.
It doesn't say coat of many colors in the interlinear?
No, it does not.
Huh. I have to take a look at that. I have to take a look at that afterwards. Yours does?
Right.
Says
robe.
Says robe?
Long robe.
Okay. Well, then that's the thought. Okay, now I'll take a look at that. And there's no colors. It's not in the original Hebrew at all?
I have four different books in one. And each one of them says something different. The closest one that comes to what his Bible has is the New Revised Standard. But it seemed like others either say ornamental or brightly colored. And what you have?
Okay, then I'll take a look at that a little later on and see what's up. But I believe colors is in there somewhere. But I'll look it up. Ornamental even sounds like the same thing. He mentions in one translation it's ornamental. So that would be basically the same idea or same concept. And it probably did have ornaments on it. It was something beautiful. But we'll take a look at that later on to clarify it, though. But that's interesting. But nevertheless, going on, it says here, for behold, we were binding sheaves, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright. Your sheaves made obeisance to my sheaf. And going on, and his brother said to him, they understood immediately. You know, the sheaf is representative of abundance and wealth and so forth. And, you know, with wealth comes power. So they understood immediately what the dream meant. It was a simple thing. And his brother said, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. It wasn't a wise thing, but you know, I want you to keep in mind. Keep thinking about this, because this is just amazing. It's amazing. You realize God is using all this? You know, you realize when God gave him that dream, he knew the frame of Joseph. He knew he would more than likely go tell his brothers, talk to him, and he knew his frame. A young man is 17 years old. That kind of power is difficult not to use it, you know. to your advantage. And he knew the response that Joseph's brothers would have. They would hate him. All this is being set up, brethren. Don't you see it? Because God has a plan. He has a plan. And going on here, and he dreamed yet another dream and told his brother. He just didn't have enough. He just had to push it a little further. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it his brother and said, behold, I've dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him. Well, he knew that that was just not right for him to be telling his brothers that. His father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother? So Jacob understood the meaning that the mother was the moon and Jacob the sun, and the 12, the other stars, 11 stars were the sons of Jacob. And of course you see that same symbolism used in Revelation 12, exact same symbolism dealing with Israel in Revelation 12. Shall I and thy mother and thy brother indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? And his brother envied him, but his father observed the saying. That word observed means he kept it in his heart. Jacob heard it, and even though he knew, you know, he was wrong for, you know, saying this in the way that he did to his brother, but at the same time, Jacob was experienced. He knew God might be working with him, so he kept it in his heart. He hid it away in his mind. And his brother envied him, but his father observed the saying. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Jacob, do not your brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said unto them, here I am. And he said to him, go, I pray, and see where what, if it is well with your brother and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what are you looking for? And he said, I'm looking for my brother. Tell me, I pray you, where they feed the flock. And the man said, they are departed, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brother and found them at Dothan. They were trying to get away from him. As far from him as they can get. They really were. You know, they were tired of him peering into their business. You know, exposing them. And so they call themselves taking the sheep and moving them far away where Joseph wouldn't be able to find them. And they said one to another, verse 18, and when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. They wanted to kill him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer comes. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. Now, I want you to keep something in mind about this from a prophetic standpoint, because just as the brothers of Joseph were jealous of him back then and wanted to do him harm, it's the same today. And as we get to the end of prophecy, of the prophetic cycle, the brothers of Joseph will turn against him once again. They will. And they will want to do him harm. Look at the situation like today. Look at all the problems we have with France. It's one of the brothers of Joseph. But boy, they just fight, you know, the U.S. left and right. In fact, at one time, I think historically, there was a 100 years war. Anybody remember about that? You remember that from school? The 100 years war. You know who that was between? Who? England and France. 100 years war. Unreal. That means they were continually at war to one degree or another for 100 years. England and France. Brothers. And who is France? Reuben, the firstborn. And Reuben has been jealous ever since that the birthright was taken from him. He can't stand seeing Joseph having the preeminence. And to this very day, they are like that. Going on. And it says here, come now there, let us slay him, cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. In other words, we'll see his dreams come true. That we slam, you know, won't be no coming true of those dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. You know, he hated him, but he didn't want to kill him. He had enough respect for his father that he didn't want to kill Joseph. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So he didn't want them to kill him. And that's because Reuben did have enough respect for his father that he didn't want to take him away from his father. And it came to pass when Joseph was coming to his brethren that they stripped Joseph of his coat of many colors, it says here, or colors. Let me look over here. It says 23. It says here, pieces. But anyway, I don't know if that's right either, but we'll find out later. But anyway, going on, and they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spices and balm and myrrh, and going to carry it down to Egypt, going there to trade. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? So, well, one of the traits of Judah showed up. They figured, hey, you know, let's not just kill him, at least make some money out of the deal. You know? Let's at least make a profit. You know, it's not wrong to notice that there are certain specific characteristics that various people do have. That's not a wrong thing. And there's nothing wrong with the characteristic if it's used rightly. But sometimes it's used wrongly. He said, what profit? And then verse 27, come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh, and his brethren were content. In other words, let's not kill him, but we can profit from him. Let's take advantage of him. You know, let's sell him. And I tell you, when we get to the end, I think we're going to see a lot of selling out going on. This country is going to be sold down the drain. You know, we're in trouble. We are in big trouble, brother. And I tell you, I don't know how closely you're following the news, but we're in big trouble. The situation with Korea and Iraq, we're putting ourselves between, as Mike would say, between a rock and a harder place. We really are. The North Koreans, they've got nuclear weapons already, brother. You realize they got at least two of them? And now with them restarting their plants, they can have as many as five or six in 6 months. There's only one alternative we have. Either we go in and drop bombs all over the place and just completely smash everything they've got, or we're going to have to sell out, or you know, or bribe them or whatever. And it's not going to work. These people are starving to death, but they would rather build bombs. They want power. I predict, and this is my own little prediction, the only way the United States is going to be able to deal with that situation over there, and that is going to backfire on them, but it's the only alternative they have. Maybe God is at work, because he tends to close those doors that way, is to give the Japanese nuclear weapons. And that's a frightening thought. That is a frightening thought. But you know what? I think it's going to come down to that. They're going to have to give the Koreans, South Koreans, and the Japanese nuclear weapons to maintain a balance of a nuclear deterrent in the region. That's what they're going to be forced to have to do. They have no other alternative. And that's the only thing that could keep the North Koreans in check, because now the North Koreans got two other neighbors that are against them with nuclear weapons. It's the only thing that could keep them in check, potentially. But even that's not going to work. As we know from Bible prophecy, all of Asia is ultimately going to end up united. It's working out a certain way, isn't it? It's moving in a certain direction. But going on here. So, what verse we're in? 28. Yes, they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. Verse 29, and Reuben returned into the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brother and said, the child is not, and where shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood, which is what their original plan was to do, remember? Kill him and say an evil beast killed him. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, this have we found, and we don't know whether it is your sons or not. Your sons or not. You get these little nuances in the phrases and the wording, and you see what their attitude was. I mean, they were really just filled with evil at this point. To even where they would deceive their own father about his death. And he knew it and said, it is my son's coat. An evil beast has devoured him. Joseph is without a doubt rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. Now Jacob is faced with another tremendous trial. This child that he loved so dearly and even exalted has been taken away from him. God allowing Jacob once again to go through a tremendous trial. And brother, you have to understand something. God will try us all from time to time and more than once throughout our lives. This life is a journey that will be filled at various times with trials to test us, to train us, to shape us, to mold us, and perfect us. Like taking gold through fire. And he does that with everyone that's a child of his. And of course, sometimes when we're going through trials, we can feel like, God, you know, are you sure this is the best thing? Or Lord, is this right? Is this good? It sure doesn't feel good. And we can maybe sometimes get a little doubtful, fearful. But for those whom God has called, he's there. He's right there, every step of the way. And this is what we see through the book of Genesis. This is what we see in the story. Because God is with Jacob. He continues to be with him, even in the midst of this trial. He continues to be with Joseph, even though he's thrown in prison, as we shall see. And sometimes some of the greatest manifestations of God is when we're in the midst of our greatest trials. In fact, God uses trial oftentimes to reveal that he's with us. The contrast of the circumstances and the experiences that we go through, and then God's intervention, the contrast of it, even makes even all the more vivid to us that God is involved. Think about Oprah this week. That situation. Because the contrast of where she was Monday and then where she was Thursday, quite stark. Monday was looking rough. And what about all the weeks up to Monday, not knowing how things were going to be worked out? Yes, Morris.
You know, in a way, I've been praying for correction. First, I started praying for correction and guidance in the ministry, thinking of the United Church of God. Then I started applying that to all ministry and all of us, too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And just recently, when I was reading about some of the things going on in Britain, I decided to put it to our nation,
mm-hmm.
as well, the same thing, same basic thing, correction in mercy and merciful correction,
because mm-hmm.
they're slightly different.
Right.
At least in my mind, they are.
Yeah, yeah. Correction is mercy and merciful correction. We don't want to be corrected to out of existence. So we want merciful correction. That's for sure. That's right. So going on here. So Jacob rent his clothes, put sackcloth upon his loins, and he mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And you know, like I said, every time I read this story, every part of it touches me. You know, you could feel the sorrow of Jacob. And he says, in other words, in essence, what he's saying is, I will not have another happy day for the remainder of my life. From this day forward, I shall mourn. Can you imagine that? He said, from this day forward, my son has been taken away from me. and from this day forward I shall mourn. And he did. He mourned from that day forward. And many years passed by from that day forward. A total of 13 years passed by. 13 years of mourning for Jacob. Before I had the experience I had when my first wife died, I could not have imagined what that was like. But now I know. I know what that is like. And I mourned for years. I could not drive past the cemetery without mourning. There were times when I accidentally drove past. And then all of a sudden I look up and realize I was driving past the cemetery where she was, and I just break out and started crying. Just like that. Oh yeah, you can do that. You can do that. And you know, and Jacob did. And he mourned. And at that point, as far as he was concerned, his life was no longer worth living. You could mourn so much, in fact, that you could actually mourn and die from mourning. Realize that's possible? I never will forget the story about the McCoys and the Hatfields, who were feuding with each other down there in West Virginia-Kentucky border. Started in the Civil War, and it was just a terrible feud. They had a thing about it one time on Discovery Channel about that feud and how bad it was. And there was only one bright spot in that feud where two of the warring parties, a man and a woman from the opposite side, fell in love. And they got married. One McCoy married a Hatfield. And they did so secretly, but it was found out that they were married. And I think they either stole the girl back and brought her back to her family. I can't remember what it was. And the husband was killed by the other clan or family. What's coming on?
I've got to get an extension for this
stuff. Yeah. No, this is a new one, and this is shorter than the one we had. Yes, yes. Oh, good. Very good. Thanks. And anyway, she got the word that he was killed. This is a true story. She sat in front of the window and just went into a stupor and stayed that way for weeks and then died. Young girl. I think like 17 or 18 or something like that. But the sorrow of losing him literally killed her. And she died. Yes.
In that particular story, her family refused to take her back.
Right. Yeah. That's, is that what it was? I thought they took her back or stole her, was it? Or they took him, or took him back. Somebody, they separated some kind of way.
They got back together and she wound up pregnant.
Okay.
And her father really refused to recognize her after that.
Hmm. So she was with her family, but they would...
She was with her in-laws.
But she was with the in-laws. Okay. Well, anyway, her husband got killed. And she sat in front of that window in a stupor and died. From sorrow. Literally from sorrow. And it can do that. And it's amazing that Jacob didn't die. But it was not God's will, evidently. But he was in a deep state of sorrow in the loss of his son. Yes.
When we were talking about the characteristics of like Judah, mm-hmm. and Reuben wanted to save Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And Reuben is France. France has a love-hate relationship.
A love-hate relationship. That's
anyway,
it.
And I'm not politically astute as I should be, but does France have any other allies when it comes right down to the wire?
No, except us.
Okay, so they're just arrogant with everybody.
They're just arrogant with everybody. No other allies except the United States. And of course, you're right. France helped the United States during the War of Independence. And then France helped, I believe it was, the South in the Civil War. Until they finally blockaded them and they couldn't bring supplies and stuff in.
We also saved them twice.
In two world wars. Saved them twice, yeah. So, yeah, it's a love-hate relationship. It really is. So he said he's going to go down his grave mourning. And the Midianites sold Joseph into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Interesting situation. Now, you know, God is planning. Now, you got to remember now, God is the one that's doing this every step of the way. It's God doing this every step of the way. He's allowed the circumstances to develop, set the stage even with the dreams. The brothers of Joseph would become hateful toward him. The father would love Joseph all the more. This would create more and more jealousy. They would eventually, you know, want to kill him. But instead of killing him, they would throw him into a pit. And God just so happened to have a band of Ishmaelites coming by at that precise moment in time. They sell him to the Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites sell him to one of the highest officers of Pharaoh in the land. All that, all these events, can God do these things? Yeah. He's a supreme genius. He can do all of that. Nobody can play chess with God. Nobody. So anyway, going on in chapter 38. Now we have a little bit of a digression in chapter 38. And actually chapter 38, most commentators, and I believe they're right, chapter 38 probably comes somewhere around chapter 32 or 3. It should be there rather than here. Because the events, this is sort of like an inset chapter, and it's actually going back to some events that have already happened, transpired. But it's important for one particular reason, this chapter. And so it's necessary to cover it. For that particular reason, I won't go into details and explanation of the reason, but here's what I'll do. I'll just explain briefly, rather than reading the whole chapter. In this chapter is the episode of Judah and his indiscretion. And Judah marries a Canaanite woman, number one. And then after he marries a Canaanite woman, he has three sons. Two of them die because one is just plain evil. Named Ur. Another one dies because Judah sends him to his brother's wife to gender seed, which was part of the law of that time to keep the seed of that line going. And that brother goes in and he spills his seed upon the ground and refuses to follow through with that responsibility. He wasn't killed because he refused the responsibility, brother. You have to understand something there. Because of his attitude. See, he was willing to go in and have pleasure. See, if he had just said, no, I don't want to do it, and never went in at all, he probably would have been better off. But the fact that he went in and had pleasure and then spilled his seed, it was like, you know, I'll go in and use her, but I'm not gonna let her have a child from me. And that attitude was, of course, evil in the eyesight of God, and God slew him. So the woman that those two were involved with, her name was Tamar. And I don't know if Tamar was a Canaanite or not. It doesn't say, but she was living certainly in Canaan, and her family was living in Canaan. One can assume she may have been a Canaanite, although we have to remember, too, that Abraham had a pretty large household that no doubt may have spread out in the parts of Canaan at that time, too. He had servants, maidservants, and others in the house of Abraham, the house of Isaac. Some of them may have spread out in the different places and servants that have been brought with him coming out of Ur of the Chaldees. There's a possibility that Tamar and so forth might have been of that particular line of people, but I don't know that. One has to assume on the lack of information that Tamar was a Canaanite in the land. And there are other theories that have been put forth by some other people, but those theories I have not been able to substantiate at all. So I just simply don't accept them, but without further proof. But Tamar, as far as I can tell, she was a Canaanite in the land. And so he tells her to go stay with her father, that when his third son grows up, he's not far from being mature, I'll send him to you. Because that was the way things were done. Well, Judah had no intent of sending that third son. Because he saw the other two sons get killed. So he wasn't going to take a chance on the third son getting killed too. So he had made up his mind he was not going to send the third son, whose name was Shua, I believe his name was. So anyway, when he was grown and had not sent him, Tamar, realizing that he really wasn't going to send him, she decides to come up with this scheme. She hears that Judah is coming near where she lives down the road. So she goes a little ways down the road, sets up a tent, and pretends to be a harlot. And Judah, who was a very licentious individual. Now, I want you to think about this. All these people are normal human beings. These are carnal people without God's Spirit. Yet, God still used the circumstances. Even the ones he didn't bring about himself, and the ones that were direct result of their own choices, he still used the circumstances. So Judah comes there, you know, his wife had died and he had mourned for her, so he had been without a woman for a while, and he's coming down the road and here's this here harlot, or he thinks is a harlot, and he offers to give her money for sex, because that's what harlots do. And she said, well, you know, what will you give me? So she wanted to make sure she got something that would be his property and that was recognizable, because she had a plan. So she said, give me your staff. And it was something else, you can read that, that she asked for. Well, he gave them to her. Then after he was gone, she went back to her family. But 3 months later, she was pregnant. And it was told Judah that Tamar has played the harlot. So at this point, he was going to slay her, take her life. You know why? Because, see, when you have someone that's espoused by the law of Israel then, and even the law under the Old Covenant later on with Moses, if you're espoused to someone, and she was actually espoused to his third son, for him to be her husband, even though Judah really wasn't going to, you know, he's being a hypocrite here, because he really wasn't going to give his third son to her. But from a public standpoint, she was espoused to his son. And by being with another man, it was the same as adultery. And what was the penalty of adultery? Death. So Judah was going to slay her. So she pulls out the stuff that he gave her that night. That had to be a very embarrassing moment. That had to be an incredibly humiliating moment. She pulls out the cane and the other pledge that he'd given her and said, whose are the man's are these? And then he realized he had been tricked. Now, the real point of this story comes down later, and I'm going to read that part now. And read in, let's start in verse 25. When she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, am I with child? And she said, discern, I pray thee, whose are these? The signet, the bracelet, and the staff. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son. I said Shua, but it's Shelah. And he knew her again no more. He never touched her again, period. He realized he, you know, because that was incest, really. So he was really guilty of incest and could be stoned himself. So he never touched her. And it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And this is the main part of this story. Not just only Judah's indiscretion. It's important to understand that the line of Christ, there's not a lot of glorified stuff in that line. So it's important to look at these things. Because we could easily, you know, exalt the flesh. No, the flesh is not to be exalted. Christ is, but not the flesh. Because there are a lot of things that went on in that line that was not good stuff. You realize that also another harlot was in the line of Christ? Anybody know who it was? Rahab. Rahab the harlot. Rahab the harlot married, I believe, the father of the father of Boaz, I believe it was. Who she married. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that went on in that line as you go down through Scripture. So anyway, she had these two children, and this is the main part of the story. And I'm only going to read this part here, and I'm not going to go into an in-depth explanation until we get to Genesis 49. And in Genesis 49, when we get to the prophecy of Judah, then I'll come back to this and explain it in more detail. So anyway, the midwife's one child, this is almost like Jacob and Esau right here, the one child comes forth, and his hand comes out. So she knows it's twins, right? So she wants to recognize who is the firstborn. Which one's the firstborn? You know, and it took note of those things. So she ties this scarlet thread or cloth around his hand. But all of a sudden, he pulls his hand back. And this other one comes forth. The other twin breaches, actually separates himself from the other twin. Now, you know God is doing that too, right? He's doing that also. Separates himself from the other twin and breaches the other twin past him. And he comes out first instead of the one that was actually the one about to be born first. Now, why does God go through all that symbolism? We're going to talk about that when we get to Genesis 4. You know, that is really fascinating. Really fascinating. Because there's something going on here that God has planned in order to maintain the kingly line of Judah down through the centuries. And at some point, this breach was to be closed back up again. This breach that takes place here between these two brothers. So the one brother's name Pharis, he's the one that breached past the other brother, and his name meant breach. And the other one was Zerah, I believe it was. Let's read it. He drew back his hand. Behold, his brother came out. She said, "How have you broken forth? This breach be upon you." Therefore his name was called Pharis. And after it came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah, which meant rising, if I recall. I believe it meant rising. So one brother was breach and one brother was to rise. It was out of the line of Pharis that King David came forth from, and ultimately Christ. Other brother Zerah disappears from the scene, and we know nothing about what happened until we go into history and find out who that brother was, where that brother went, and it is a fascinating tale. A truly fascinating tale. At some point, this brother becomes very important in God's plan. It's almost like God takes him and reserves him for something else later on, to close up the breach that had been made at the beginning of the birth. I want you to keep that in mind, because we will come back to it. Now let's go on to chapter 39. It was my goal to get through chapter 40 today. So let's go to chapter 39. And we'll come back to that probably next week, because I don't know, maybe week after next. It's going to probably take a couple more weeks to get to chapter 50. But possibly 2 weeks from now. And Joseph was brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him of the hands of the Ishmaelites, which had brought him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph. You hear that? He was with Joseph. He's a slave, but the Lord was with Joseph. It must have been a pretty dark hour for this young 17-year-old in that pit. It must have been a dark moment for him. But the Lord was with him. It says, and the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, so he prospered. Joseph was a leader. And whatever he tackled, he did well and made an impression. And the master of the household, Potiphar, could see his abilities, and he used those abilities. He says, "Well, you know, this is a smart young man, and he's an industrious young man, and he's a hard-working young man. You know, I can use him, and he's smart, he's intelligent, he understands math, And so he pretty much put him over his household, is what he did. Joseph kind of ran things. And here he is a slave, but he ended up running things. Going on, Joseph found grace in verse 3, and his master saw that the Lord is with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he made him overseer over his house. And all that he had, he put into his hand. But how did he see that? How did he know that? Who did that? Once again, it is God that's granting favor. And going on, and it came to pass from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. Remember what we said last week? That wherever any one of you as God's people are at, and you are a servant of the Lord, God will bless that situation for your sake, for the time that he has that to be a purpose, to be used in your life. Because then, you know, the time comes for something else too at some point. He'll let something happen to move you on. I really believe that every job pretty much I've had, I believe God actually put me where I was. I really believe that. I believe God put me where I was. There have been times I've been out of work and looking for a job and I could not so much as crack a door. And I literally, like any one of you, got discouraged and just gave up. You know, just, so what's the use? And became frustrated. And then get a phone call and say, oh, you know, we got a job over here doing so and so and so. I said, oh, really? Okay. So I went, got the job. And then found out that after I got hired, that the manager of the place was mad that the person hired me and wanted to hire somebody else. But now he couldn't change it since the other guy hired me. I've had that happen. And I've seen God's hand right there. Right there. And when I got those jobs, I made sure that I worked hard and I did the best I could at it so they wouldn't want to get rid of me. So they want to keep me. Going on, it says here, and he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught. In other words, anything he had, he didn't hold anything back. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. He was a good looking guy. He was also good looking. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph because he was a good looking guy. And she was a lustful person. Get the feeling her husband probably was an older man and she was probably much, much younger. That's my impression here. But it doesn't say, but that's the impression I get. Verse 8, but he refused and said unto his master, why, behold, my master, you know, he doesn't hold anything from me and he has committed all that he has to my hand. And there is none greater in his house than I. And he has not kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How can you do this great wickedness and sin against God? So he actually preached to her, you know, and no telling what was going on at this point. And it came to pass that she spake to Joseph day by day that he hearkened not on her to lie by her. So she became, what do they call it today? Fatal attraction? Obsessed. A stalker almost, you know. That's what she began to do. And it came to pass that she spake to Joseph day by day that he hearkened not to her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph went to the house to do his business. He went in there to use the bathroom. So they had indoor bathrooms in Egypt. Well, they had them in Rome too as well. And there was none of the men of the house there with him. And she, because that's what Joseph did. He ran. What character? He ran. But now she was a woman scorned. You heard the expression about a woman scorned. And she was a woman scorned. And she called unto the men of her house and spake unto them, saying, see, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. Boy, how often have we heard stories like that? And she laid up his garment by her until his Lord came home. And she spake unto him according to these words, saying, the Hebrew servant which you have brought unto us came in unto me to mock me. You know, I'd be willing to bet he didn't believe it. It doesn't say here, but I'd be willing to bet he really didn't believe it. But because she had made this public cry out of honor for his wife, he had no alternative but to take an action. He knew the kind of person Joseph was. That's why he had put him over everything. He knew the kind of character Joseph had. He trusted him. He knew his wife, too. I bet you that. He knew. But because it was now a public situation out of honor for his wife and his own honor, he had to act. And it came to pass when his master heard the words of his wife, which he spake to him, saying, after this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound. Now it's interesting. I want you to think about this again. He could have had him killed. He could have took his life. But he didn't. He put him in prison, but he not only put him in prison, where did he put him at? The king's prison. Now, from what I read in some of the commentaries that I looked into, it said that the king's prison was the place where only people of high rank was put. I guess it would be sort of like today when you have certain prisoners that put in these, what do they call it? Country club type prisons, you know. It was sort of like that, where the royalty was put. They didn't put, you know, the bad criminals and low-down folks there. Only the cream of the crop went into this particular prison. And that's where he put him. He could have easily put him somewhere else, but he didn't. And I think because deep down inside he knew. I think deep down inside he knew, but he had to go through with this, and so he put him in the king's prison. And wasn't that by God's design? It's by God's design. God is setting all this up as to where he is taking Joseph. Now you might ask the question, why would God go through all of this elaborate arrangement this way? Maybe that question might cross your mind. Yes, Gunner?
Character.
Number one, character. Remember how Joseph was when he started out. Remember that? Young teenager, self-righteous, somewhat arrogant, a little bit inconsiderate, not thinking, impetuous. And what was God getting ready to prepare him for? As we know the story, he was getting ready to prepare him to be a ruler. He was going to have to learn some things. That was one of the major reasons, character, that God was doing this. And plus, of course, God was working that way for some other reasons as well. In order that we realize that it was not by human power. Not by human power. The circumstances are so absurd and so, you know, ridiculous on the surface of it. There's just no way things could work out that way. In normal life, it just don't work like that. Just don't. But look at what was happening here. So, anyway, he's thrown into the prison. And then verse 21, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Now, once again, you see there? And we have our problems and our troubles, and we say, woe is me, where is God? And yes, I'm right with you. I've done it too many times. Where is God? And in your darkest hour, in your lowest place, God is right there with you. If you're his servant, if you belong to him, he hasn't gone anywhere. And you have to remember, he has a plan for you. And if God is allowing you to go to a particular circumstance, it's part of his plan. And he's working something out. We may not know the particular details of it, but he's working it out. Our job is to remain faithful. Trust him. Continue to seek him. Don't allow the circumstances to overthrow us. Because eventually he will unveil what he's doing. It might take a long time. Because in this particular case, it took 13 years. The time he was 17, it was 13 years. Look at Jacob, though. He worked 20 years for Laban before he got out of there. And then he still ran into some other problems later on. And he had to go through this same 13-year period. Mourning the loss of his son. 13 years. Thinking his son was dead. God allowed him to think that. God could have felt sorry for him. Oh, you know, maybe I'll let him know his son is still alive. I don't want him to have to go through this. And it would seem like, you know, isn't that cruel of God to let Jacob go 13 years thinking his son was dead? But God had a purpose. A purpose that was higher than the immediate gratification. Much higher. And he can see where we can't see. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison. My, that's unbelievable. Think about that for a moment. You're in jail. What do we call them today? I think they call them trustees. You're in jail. I never really liked that term, trustees. You know? I wonder, can you really trust these guys? You know, really? But they have these trustees and they give them responsibility even over the other prisoners and stuff. Joseph is the first trustee that we know about in history. Very first one, a trustee. They probably never even did something like that before. In Egypt, trustees in the prisons. No, God gave this man favor. And he became the keeper, committed the prisoners unto him. And whatsoever they did there, he was the doer of it. Whatever they did, Joseph was the one who ran it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him. And that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper. So once again, the keeper of the prisoner, he prospered. You know, it's a funny thing, too. God did it in a way where each one of those guys knew, too, that it seems like this is happening because of him. They knew it. Potiphar knew it, that God was with Joseph. This keeper of the prison, he knows it. God is with Joseph. It was made known to them. And how is that made known? I cannot help but feel that Joseph shared knowledge about the true God with these individuals. He gave testimony to them about the God that he served and about his father Jacob. He probably told them the story of what God had done in his father's life. So they knew that he was devout to God. And they saw certain things in his character and his personality. And then they began to be blessed in certain ways. As they did certain things for Joseph, blessings came toward them. And as they did some more stuff came toward them. And they began to get the correlation. They began to figure it out. But every time I do this for Joseph, this here happens. Joseph, God is really with him. God gave a witness and a testimony to them. So he made it across to chapter 40. Let's see if we can make it through that. And it came to pass after these things that the butler of the king of Egypt and his baker had offended their lord, the king of Egypt. Oh, another unusual set of circumstances. God has set up the chess pieces. Once again, he's making another move here. It came to pass that the butler and the baker offended the Lord. Now, how did they offend? Well, it doesn't tell us specifically, but my guess is, you know, when you think of the butler who carries the cup of wine and things like this to the king, and the baker who cooks his food, how would they offend him? Other than if the Pharaoh thought they were going to take his life. Because back in those days, as one of the chief methods they used to kill somebody royalty, poison his drink, or poison his food. So I'm just kind of guessing, I don't know this to be a fact, that they were accused of conspiracy to kill him. But they didn't have all the evidence. So what they did is put him in jail, and they probably were in the process of investigating the situation. So it goes on here. And Pharaoh was angry against two of his officers, against the chief of the butlers and against the chief of the bakers. And he put them in ward in the house of the captain of the guard into the prison, the place where Joseph was bound. Because, you know, that's where, what? All those, that was the king's prison, remember? That's where Joseph was. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them, and they continued a season in ward. So Joseph was even given direct responsibility of those two men. God working all the details out right down to the last detail of what he was about to do. And they dreamed a dream, both of them, and each man his dream in one night, each man according to the interpretation of his dream, the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, which were bound in the prison. And Joseph came in unto them in the morning and looked upon them, and behold, they were sad. They were depressed by the dream they had because they didn't understand. And this was a very real dream. Not like our dreams. These were real. These dreams were like it was something that really had happened. And they said to him, "We have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it." And Joseph said unto them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me then, I pray you." And see, you notice something different here too. Another thing that just popped up here. Did you notice what Joseph said about the dream this time around? Now, when he talked to his brothers, remember how he talked? "I dreamed a dream." Remember that? But what does he say here this time? What does he say? Let's read it again. He says, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" Entirely different attitude. "Tell me then, I pray you." And the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, behold, a vine was before me, and the vine were three branches, and it was as though it budded, and her blossoms shot forth, and the clusters thereof brought forth ripe grapes. And Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now you know it was God that was giving him this. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up your head and restore you unto your place, and you shall deliver Pharaoh's cup into his hand after the former manner which you were as a butler. So evidently Pharaoh would discover, and an evidence would come to him that the butler was not guilty of whatever he was accused of. And he would come back in the service of Pharaoh. And then he goes on, and here's what Joseph said. But think on me when it shall be well with you, and show kindness, I pray you, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. You know, he was getting antsy. He wanted out of prison. For indeed I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also have I done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, I also was in my dream, and behold, I had 3 white baskets on my head. And in the uppermost basket there was all manner of baked meats for Pharaoh, and the birds did eat them out of the basket upon my head. And Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation thereof. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up your head from off you, and shall hang you in a tree, and the birds shall eat your flesh from off you. Now that's pretty blunt and pretty direct, and he didn't mince words about it. And see, one reason Joseph could do that, Joseph knew he was guilty of whatever it was he had done. And they were going to, whatever evidence that was lacking, they were going to come to the conclusion he was going to try to assassinate Pharaoh. And at that point, he wasn't coming back. He was a dead man, and it was no sense playing around with him. Tell him the truth, and be like, you're a dead man, buddy. That's it. Yet within 3 days shall Pharaoh lift up your head. And verse 20, it came to pass the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast unto all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief baker and the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. And he restored the chief butler unto his butlership again. And he gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him. You know, he got caught up in the excitement of being restored and everything, and he was just happy, and he just completely forgot about what Joseph said. How long was it before Joseph got an answer to this prayer? Remember me, he said. And I have no doubt he prayed about it. Don't forget me. How long was it? Chapter 41. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years, even after this situation, it was another 2 whole years. God made him wait 2 more years. Has any of us got tired of waiting on God? It is difficult at times, I admit it. It can be. But God has us wait sometimes for our character and for many reasons. And we also have to remember something else too. God is working and has chosen to work in the realm of men in the fulfillment and accomplishing of things. And because men are bound by time, some things just automatically are going to take time. Not that God can do it instantly on his own power, he could. But he has chosen to work through the realm of men, and he's chosen purposely, brethren, to some extent to limit himself, to some extent, to limit himself to the parameters of time and of men. Because you see, God does things in such a way, he does not necessarily forcibly completely take over the right of choice from human beings. He allows that to still function and work. But he manipulates it as well. But without forcibly taking over, at least in most cases. But there are a few occasions where God has done that, but that's a whole other story. We can go into some other areas of scripture where God has just simply taken someone's thoughts and mind and everything over and made them do what he wanted them to do. But those occasions are very, very, very rare. Most of the time he does it like a chess master. He's moving human pieces. in a certain way, not compromising the integrity of their free choice along the way, but putting up the roadblocks here and the roadblocks there and, you know, circumstances here, and so that it moves in the direction he wants it to go. And that, when you're doing that with human beings, time's involved. Remember the case of Daniel? When he was praying to God, you know, about an answer to some of the things that he didn't understand and really troubled him, and it took 3 weeks before he got an answer to prayer. He fasted for 3 whole weeks. And then he finds out that God had heard him on the first day. But when he sent the answer to him, what happened? Well, the angel Gabriel got caught up in a fight with other demons. There were other circumstances. Now, could God have it caused those demons to just disappear and leave? Yes, he could have done that. But he allowed that to take place for a couple of reasons. Number one, God is still testing and training his angelic hosts. They're still going through training. And so he's allowing their training to be involved. And the time factor comes into play once again with human beings to teach us. So he allowed that. And he allowed that for us today so that we would know that sometimes our angels, you know, are hung up in battle. They're on the way, though. See, the main thing is they're on the way. They're en route. But sometimes they're hung up in battle. And God allows us to look in his word and see that so that we can be encouraged that the answer is already given. But we have to wait. We have to be patient because there's something far bigger than just ourselves being worked out. Far bigger than just ourselves being worked out. And God wants us to be in tune with that. And so it was 2 full years before this event reaches an apex. And behold, the king up out of the river. After 2 full years, Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river, and behold, the king up out of the river. 7 well-favored kine and fat sheds, it says here, or cows, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, 7 other kine, I think is cows, came up after them out of the river, ill-favored and lean flesh, and stood by the other kine upon the brink of the river. Well, I'll make a long story short here. We'll come back to this next week. But he has this dream that ultimately we'll see next week. God is going to bring about great prosperity for a period of about 7 years in Egypt, and for another period of 7 years there's going to be great famine and economic collapse, not just in Egypt but throughout all of the entire world at this point. The whole world. I want you to keep that in mind, because God is going to cause a, remember I mentioned about the ice age? God is going to cause an ecological disaster to take place throughout the entire world, where the whole world is going to be under famine, and for 7 years it's going to be that way, and no one will be able to grow food anywhere. Why? And it will be food only in one place in the entire world. And it would force his servants to have to go into Egypt. They would have to make a choice whether or not to stay where they are and die, or go into Egypt. And Egypt would be the only place where there would be grain. And Joseph would be the very one used to make sure they had it. You see how all the events have conspired to this moment now. To this moment in which God is getting ready to fulfill the prophecy he gave to Abraham about his descendants going down into Egypt. Remember? Remember what we read right back when we were reading about Abraham? And back in Genesis, I think, 15, I think it was. Not sure, but I think it was Genesis 15, where we read that. God told him about his descendants being in Egypt, and they would be delivered from there. Well, he's got to work all that out to get them there. And that's where they're going to end up. But we'll come back and finish up chapters 41, 2, and 3, and 4, maybe, next week. And one or two of them, we might be able to skip a few events, but it's kind of hard to skip anything in this story of Joseph. It's just so, I probably won't be able to skip anything. We'll see. But we'll finish up with at least about 4 more chapters, God willing, next week, and in the story of Joseph, because it is truly fascinating as you watch God fulfill his plan and the way he works and the circumstances that he's working in. And I don't know about you, as I read it, I realize that there's no circumstance, no situation in our lives in which God is not there and not involved. No matter what it is, even your own wrong choices. Because he allows for all that. And he even uses the wrong choices, the wrong decisions, and he uses those circumstances to still work out his purpose for those who are his servants. You see how this is happening here? And that encourages me. I hope it encourages you. It sure encourages me. And it, you know, just fills you with faith and with hope and understanding and love for God. Love for him. So we'll end it on that, and now have I'll find a song. Unless there's any other comments or questions on any of the material we've gone through today, or yes.
Study was 17 years. I don't see that in this Bible. So
yeah, it's there.
17 or 13 years, and then add that to 17 would be 30 years.
Right. Yeah, because it tells you it's 30 years when he gets in there, and you go back and it tells you it was 17 years when he's taken.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when you subtract 17 to 30, it's a total of 13 years. Yeah. So, long time to go through something like that. And it's interesting, too. I hadn't thought about it until this second, the number 13. You know, 13, the 13 states of the United States, of Manasseh, 13. 13 was the number of the tribes, total, the number of the tribes of Israel when you count both half tribes. Remember that? And number 13 kind of comes into play with Israel, doesn't it? Yeah. Interesting. 13 years with Joseph. So, you know, God gives these little signatures, you know, along the way. Little signatures along the way. Very interesting. But anyway, we'll have one final song and then close out with prayer.